Though he had never been fully convinced Ron was guilty, he was not convinced he was innocent, either. Like most folks in Ada, he had always felt the guy had a loose screw or two. But he was anxious to see Ron and to make sure his retrial was conducted fairly. The murder was 15 years old and still unsolved. Judge Landreth had great sympathy for the Carters and their ordeal. It was time to settle the matter. On Sunday, July 13, 1997, Ron Williamson left McAllister, never to return. He was driven by two Pontotoc County deputies to Eastern State Hospital in Vineta. The sheriff, Jeff Glaze, told a newspaper reporter that the prisoner behaved himself. "They didn't report any trouble out of him whatsoever," Glaze said. "But when you're in shackles, leg irons, and a straitjacket, there's not really much you can do to cause a lot of trouble." It was Ron's fourth admission to Eastern State. He was placed in the pre-trial program to be evaluated and treated so that he could one day stand trial. Judge Landreth set a trial date for July 28th, but then postponed it pending an evaluation of Ron by the doctors at Eastern State. Though Bill Peterson did not object to the evaluation, he left little doubt as to his opinion of Ron's competency. In a letter to Mark Barrett, he said, "My personal opinion is that he was competent under Oklahoma law, and that his disruptions in court were merely a show of anger at the time he was tried and convicted. And he functioned reasonably well in jail." Bill Peterson liked the idea of DNA testing. He had never wavered in his belief that Williamson was the killer, and now it could be proven with real science. He and Mark Barrett swapped letters and quibbled over the details. Which lab? Who pays for what? When to start the testing? But both agreed that the testing would take place. Ron was stabilized and doing better. Any place, even a mental hospital, was an improvement over McAllister. Eastern State had several units, and he was placed in a heavily secured one, complete with bars on the windows and plenty of razor wire to look at. The rooms were small, old, and not very nice, and the secured unit was overflowing with patients. Ron was lucky to have a room. Others slept in beds in the hallways. He was immediately examined by Dr. Curtis Grundy and found to be incompetent. Ron appreciated the nature of the charges against him, but was unable to assist his attorneys. Dr. Grundy wrote to Judge Landreth and said that with proper treatment, Ron might become competent enough to stand trial. 2 months later, Dr. Grundy evaluated him again. In a detailed, 4-page report sent to Judge Landreth, Dr. Grundy determined that Ron, 1, was able to appreciate the nature of the charges against him, 2, was able to consult with his lawyer and rationally assist in the preparation of his defense, and 3, was mentally ill and required further treatment. He should continue to receive psychiatric treatment throughout his trial participation for the purpose of maintaining his competence to stand trial. Additionally, Dr. Grundy determined that Ron was harmless, saying, "Mr. Williamson does not appear to pose an immediate, significant threat to himself or others should he be released without further inpatient treatment. He currently denies experiencing suicidal and homicidal ideation or intent. He has not displayed aggressive behavior towards himself or others during this hospitalization. The current assessment of his dangerousness is based upon his placement in a structured, secure setting and may not be applicable to unstructured environments." Judge Landreth set the competency hearing for December 10th, and Ron was moved back to Ada. He checked into the Pontotoc County Jail, said hello to his old pal, John Christian, and was placed in his old cell. Annette was soon there to see him, with food, and she found him upbeat, hopeful, and very happy to be home. He was excited about a new trial and the prospect of proving his innocence. He rambled on incessantly about Ricky Joe Simmons, with Annette constantly asking him to change the subject. He could not. The day before the hearing, he spent 4 hours with Dr. Sally Church, a psychologist hired by Mark Barrett to testify about his competency. Dr. Church had already met with him twice and reviewed the extensive records of his medical history. She had little doubt that he was incompetent to stand trial. Ron, though, was determined to prove he was ready for a trial. For 9 years he had dreamed of the chance to again confront Bill Peterson and Dennis Smith and Gary Rogers and all the liars and snitches. He'd killed no one, and he was desperate to finally prove it. He liked Mark Barrett, but he was angry that his own lawyer was trying to prove he was crazy. Ron just wanted a trial. Judge Landreth scheduled the hearing in a smaller courtroom down the hall from the main one where Ron had been convicted. On the morning of the 10th, every seat was taken. Annette was there, as were several reporters. Janet Chesley and Kim Marks were waiting to testify. Barney Ward was absent. The last time Ron made the short walk from the jail to the courthouse in handcuffs, he had been sentenced to die. He was 35 then, still a young man with dark hair and a stocky build and nice suit. 9 years later, he made the walk again, a white-haired, ghost-like old man in prison garb and unsteady on his feet. When he walked into the courtroom, Tom Landreth was shocked at his appearance. Ron was very happy to see Tommy up there on the bench in a black robe. When Ron nodded and smiled, the judge noticed that most of his teeth were gone. His hair was streaked yellow from the nicotine on his hands. Appearing for the state to contest Ron's claims of incompetence was Bill Peterson, who was irritated by the very notion and disdainful of the proceedings. Mark Barrett was assisted by Sarah Bonnell, a lawyer from Purcell, who would hold the second seat in Ron's retrial. Sarah was an experienced criminal lawyer, and Mark relied heavily on her. They wasted no time in proving their case. Ron was the first witness, and within seconds had everybody thoroughly confused. Mark asked him his name. Then they had the following exchange. Mark, Mr. Williamson, there's a person other than yourself who you believe committed this crime? Ron,
yes, there is. His name is Ricky Joe Simmons of 323 West 3rd Street. At the time of September 24th, 1987, confession to the Ada Police Department. That's the address he listed he was living at. I received verification there were some Simmons living at that address along with Ricky Joe Simmons. There was a Cody and a Debbie Simmons living there.
Mark, and you tried to get the word out about Ricky Simmons.
Ron, I have told a lot of people about Mr. Simmons. I've wrote to Joe Gifford. I wrote to Tom and Jerry Criswell at the funeral home, and knowing that if they bought a monument here in Ada, they would have bought it from Joe Gifford, because he's the only monument works. And Forget-Me-Not Florist handled the floral arrangements. I wrote to them. I wrote to some people at the Solo Company, where his former employer. I wrote to the glass plant, his former employer, and to the decedent's former employer.
Mark, let's back up a minute. Why was it important for you to write the monument company?
Ron, because I know Joe Gifford. When I was growing up, I mowed his yard as a kid with Bert Rose, my next-door neighbor. And knowing that, if Mr. Carter and Miss Stillwell bought a monument here in Ada, Oklahoma, they bought it from Joe Gifford because he is the only monument works here. I grew up by Gifford Monument Works.
Mark, why would you write to Forget-Me-Not Florist?
Ron, because, knowing if they bought flowers here in Ada, Miss Stillwell is from Stonewall, Oklahoma, knowing that if they bought flowers here in Ada, they possibly could have bought from Forget-Me-Not Florist.
Mark, how about the funeral home?
Ron, the funeral home is, Criswell Funeral Home is the funeral home. I read from Bill Luker's brief, stating that they are the people responsible for handling the funeral and burial arrangements for the decedent.
Mark, and it was important for you to let them know Ricky...
Ron, yes, he was an extremely dangerous man, and I asked for some support in getting him arrested.
Mark, that's because of handling funeral arrangements for Ms. Carter?
Ron, that is correct.
Mark, did you also write to the manager of the Florida Marlins?
Ron, I wrote to the third base coach of the Oakland Athletics, who later became... Yes, the manager of the Florida Marlins.
Mark, and did you ask him to keep some sort of information he gave you under his hat?
Ron, No, I told him the whole story about the Del Monte ketchup bottle that Simmons said that Dennis Smith, holding up a Del Monte ketchup bottle in his right hand on the witness stand, and Ricky Joe Simmons saying he raped the decedent with the ketchup bottle. I wrote to Renee and told him that that's the most shocking piece of evidence I've ever seen in the 44 years I've been alive.
Mark, but you know that the Florida Marlins manager told some other people about it, is that right?
Ron. Probably so, because Renee Latchman is a good friend of mine.
Mark, so is there something you've heard that makes you believe this?
Ron, oh, yes, because I used to listen to Monday Night Football, and I listened to the World Series, and I've been listening to some reports on television and through the media that Del Monte ketchup bottle has become infamous.
Mark, okay, you hear them talking.
Ron, oh, yes, definitely so.
Mark, on Monday night?
Ron, definitely so.
Mark,
and during the World Series?
Ron,
it's a cheering pep squad sick ordeal I have to go through, but it's, nonetheless, necessary for me to get... Simmons confessed that he did, in fact, rape. Rape by instrumentation and rape by forcible sodomy and murder Deborah Sue Carter at her home... at 1022 and a half East 8th Street, December the 8th, 1982.
Mark, do you also hear Deborah Carter's name mentioned during...
Ron, yes, I do.
Mark, is this during Monday Night Football also?
Ron, I hear Deborah Sue Carter's name continually.
Mark, you don't have a TV in your cell, do you?
Ron, I hear other people's television. I have heard them at Vanita. I had a television on death row. I definitely hear that I am associated with this horrible crime, and I'm doing my very dead-level best to clear my name of this stinking mess.
Mark paused so everyone could catch a breath. Spectators exchanged looks. Others were frowning, trying not to make eye contact with anyone. Judge Landreth was writing something on his legal pad. The lawyers were scribbling, too. Though putting sensible words together was not easy at the moment. From a lawyer's perspective, it was extremely difficult to examine an incompetent witness because no one, including the witness, knew what answers were likely to spew forth. Mark decided to just let him talk. In attendance for the Carter family was Christy Shepherd, Debbie's niece, who had grown up not far from the Williamsons. She was a licensed health counselor who'd spent years working with severely mentally ill adults. After a few minutes of listening to Ron, she was convinced. Later that day, she told her mother and Peggy Stillwell that Ron Williamson was a very sick man. Also watching, but for different reasons, was Dr. Curtis Grundy, Bill Peterson's chief witness. The questioning continued, though questions were unnecessary. Ron either ignored them or gave a quick answer before returning to Ricky Joe Simmons and rambling on until the next question cut him off. After 10 minutes on the stand, Mark Barrett had heard enough. Annette followed her brother and testified about his unstable thoughts and his obsession with Ricky Joe Simmons. Janet Chesley testified in detail about her representation of Ron and her efforts to get him moved into the special care unit at McAllister. She, too, described his non-stop ramblings about Ricky Joe Simmons and said that he was unable to assist with his defense because he talked of nothing else. Ron was improving, in her opinion, and she was hopeful he would one day be able to get his new trial. But that day was still far away. Kim Marks covered much of the same territory. She had not seen Ron in several months and was pleased with his improved appearance. In vivid detail, she described Ron on H-Unit and said she often thought he might die. He was progressing mentally, but was still unable to focus on anything but Ricky Joe Simmons. He was not ready for a trial. Dr. Sally Church was the final witness for Ron. In the long and colorful history of Ron Williamson's court proceedings, she was, incredibly, the first expert to testify about his mental health. He was bipolar and schizophrenic, two of the most difficult disorders to treat because the patient does not always understand what the medications do. Ron often stopped taking his pills, and that was common with the two disorders. Dr. Church described the effects, treatments, and potential causes of bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. During her examination of Ron the day before at the county jail, he asked her if she heard a television in the distance. She wasn't sure. Ron certainly did, and on the television show, they were talking about Debbie Carter and the ketchup bottle. It happened like this. He had written to Renee Latchman, a former player and coach with Oakland, and told him about Ricky Simmons and Debbie Carter and the ketchup bottle. Ron believed that Renee Latchman, for some reason, had mentioned this to a couple of sports announcers who began talking about it on the air. The story spread. Monday Night Football, the World Series, and so on. Until now, it was all over the tube. "Can't you hear them in there?" Ron yelled at Dr. Church. "They're yelling ketchup! Ketchup! Ketchup!" She concluded her testimony with the opinion that Ron was unable to assist his attorney and prepare for trial. During the recess for lunch, Dr. Grundy asked Mark Barrett if he could meet with Ron alone. Mark trusted Dr. Grundy and had no objection. The psychiatrist and the patient inmate met in the witness room at the jail. When court convened after lunch, Bill Peterson stood and sheepishly announced, "Yeah, Judge, I visited with our witness, Grundy, over the recess, and I think the state of Oklahoma would be willing to stipulate that competency is obtainable, but at this particular point in time, Mr. Williamson is not competent." After watching Ron in court and chatting with him for 15 minutes during lunch, Dr. Grundy did an about-face and changed his opinion. Ron was simply not ready for a trial. Judge Landreth ruled Ron to be incompetent and wanted him back in 30 days for another look. As the hearing was winding down, Ron said, "Could I ask a question?" Judge Landreth, "Yes, sir." Ron, "Tommy, I've known you, and I knew your dad, Paul, and I'm telling you, in honest truth, I don't know how this Duke Graham and this Jim Smith business, you know, how it correlates to Ricky Joe Simmons. I don't know that. And if that's about my competency, let me get down here within 30 days, and let's get Simmons arrested. Put him on the witness stand, show this videotape, and try to get a confession from him as to what he actually did." Judge Landreth, "I understand what you're saying." If Tommy did, in fact, understand, he was the only one in the courtroom who did so. Against his wishes, Ron was returned to Eastern State for more observation and treatment. He preferred to remain in Ada to speed things along toward his trial, and he was irritated with his lawyers for wanting him at Vinita. Mark Barrett was desperate to get him out of the Pontotoc County Jail before more snitches appeared on the scene. Then a dentist at Eastern State examined a sore in the roof of his mouth, did a biopsy, and discovered cancer. The growth was encapsulated and easily removed. The surgery was successful, and the doctor told Ron that had it gone untreated, say at the county jail or at McAllister, the cancer would have spread to his brain. Ron called Mark and thanked him for the stay at Eastern State. "You saved my life," Ron said, and they were friends again. In 1995, the state of Oklahoma drew a blood sample from every prison inmate, began analyzing them, and entered the results into its new DNA data bank. The evidence from the Carter investigation was still locked away at the OSBI lab in Oklahoma City. The blood, fingerprints, semen, and hair samples from the crime scene, along with the numerous prints and blood, hair, and saliva samples taken from the witnesses and suspects, were all in storage. The fact that the state had possession of everything did not comfort Dennis Fritz. He didn't trust Bill Peterson and the Ada police, and he certainly didn't trust their cohorts at the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. Hell, Gary Rogers was an OSBI agent. Fritz waited. Throughout 1998, he corresponded with the Innocence Project, tried to be patient, and waited. 10 years in prison had taught him patience and perseverance, and he had experienced the cruelty of false hope. A letter from Ron helped. It was a rambling 7-page hello on Eastern State letterhead, and Dennis chuckled as he read it. His old friend had not lost his wit or his fight. Ricky Joe Simmons was still loose, and damn it, Ron intended to nail him. To keep his own sanity, Dennis stayed in the law library, poring over cases. He made a hopeful discovery. His habeas corpus appeal had been filed in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma. Pontotoc County was in the Eastern District. He compared notes with the other law clerks, and the combined wisdom was that the Western District did not have jurisdiction over him. He rewrote his petition and brief, and refiled in the proper court. It was a long shot, but it energized him and gave him another fight. In January 1999, he talked by phone to Barry Scheck. Scheck was at war on many fronts. The Innocence Project was swamped with wrongful conviction cases. Dennis expressed his concern with the state having control of all the evidence, and Barry explained that that was usually the case. "Relax," he said. "Nothing will happen to the samples." He knew how to protect the evidence from tampering. Scheck's fascination with Dennis's case was simple. The police had failed to investigate the last man seen with the victim. It was an enormous red flag, and it was all Scheck needed to take the case. On January 26th and 27th, 1999, at a company called Laboratory Corporation of America, LabCorp, near Raleigh, North Carolina, the semen samples from the crime scene, the torn panties, the bed sheets, and the vaginal swabs, were tested against the DNA profiles of Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz. A DNA expert from California, Brian Raxel, had been hired by the attorneys for Ron and Dennis to monitor the testing. 2 days later, Judge Landreth delivered the news that Mark Barrett and many others had been dreaming of. The results of the DNA tests had been analyzed and confirmed at LabCorp, and the semen from the crime scene excluded Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz. As always, Annette was in close contact with Mark Barrett and knew the testing was underway somewhere. She was at home when the phone rang. It was Mark, and his first words were, "Annette, Ron is innocent." Her knees buckled, and she almost fainted. "Are you sure, Mark?" "Ron is innocent," he said again. "We just got the lab results." She couldn't talk for crying and promised to call him back later. She sat down, and for a long time she wept and she prayed. She thanked God over and over for his goodness. Her Christian faith had sustained her through the nightmare of Ron's ordeal, and now the Lord had answered her prayers. She hummed a few hymns, cried some more, then began calling family and friends. Renee's reaction was almost identical. They made the 4-hour drive to Vinita the next day. Waiting there were Mark Barrett and Sarah Bonnell. A little celebration was in order. As Ron was brought into the visitor's room, Dr. Curtis Grundy happened by and was invited to hear the good news. Ron was his patient, and they had developed a close relationship. After 18 months at Vinita, Ron was stable, making slow progress, and putting on weight. "We have some great news," Mark said, addressing his client. "The lab results are back. The DNA proves you and Dennis are innocent." Ron was instantly overcome with emotion and reached for his sisters. They hugged and wept, and then instinctively broke into "I'll Fly Away," a popular gospel hymn they had learned as children. Mark Barrett immediately filed a motion to dismiss the charges and turn Ron loose, and Judge Landreth was anxious to address the issue. Bill Peterson objected and wanted further testing on the hair. A hearing was scheduled for February 3rd. Bill Peterson opposed the motion, but he could not do so quietly. Before the hearing, he was quoted in the Ada Evening News as saying, "DNA testing of the hair samples, which was not available in 1982, will prove they were responsible for Carter's murder." The statement rattled Mark Barrett and Barry Scheck. If Peterson was cocky enough to make such public claims at such a late hour, was it possible that he knew something they didn't? Did he have access to the hair taken from the crime scene? Could the samples be switched? There were no empty seats in the main courtroom on February 3rd. Ann Kelly, a reporter for the Ada Evening News, was fascinated by the case and was covering it thoroughly. Her front-page reports were being widely read, and when Judge Landreth settled behind his bench, the room was crowded with policemen, courthouse employees, family members, and local lawyers. Barney was there, seeing nothing but hearing more than anyone. He was thick-skinned and had learned to live with Judge C's opinion from 1995. He would never agree with it, but he couldn't change it. Barney had always believed that his client had been framed by the police and Peterson, and it was wonderful watching their flimsy case unravel in the spotlight. The lawyers argued for 45 minutes, then Judge Landreth wisely decided to complete the testing of the hair before making a final decision. "Do it fast," he told the lawyers. To his credit, Bill Peterson promised, on the record and in open court, to agree to a dismissal if Williamson and Fritz were excluded by DNA testing of the crime scene hair. On February 10, 1999, Mark Barrett and Sarah Bonnell drove to the Lexington Correctional Center to see Glenn Gore in what was supposedly a routine interview. Though Ron's retrial had not been scheduled, they were preparing for it anyway. Gore surprised them by saying he had been expecting a visit. He was reading the newspapers, keeping up with events. He had read about Judge C's opinion back in 1995 and knew that another trial was somewhere in the future. They chatted for a while about that possibility, and the conversation shifted to Bill Peterson, a man Gore despised because he put him in prison for 40 years. Barrett asked Gore why he testified against Williamson and Fritz. "It was all Peterson," he said. "Peterson threatened him, said he'd go after him if he didn't help nail Williamson and Fritz." "Would you be willing to take a polygraph on this?" Mark asked. Gore said he had no problem with a polygraph and added that he had offered to take one for the police, but it never happened. The lawyers asked Gore if he would give them a saliva sample for DNA, and he said it wasn't necessary. The state already had his DNA. All prisoners were required to submit samples. As they talked about DNA, Mark Barrett told Gore that Fritz and Williamson had been tested. Gore already knew this. "Could your DNA be on her?" Barrett asked. "Probably," Gore said, because he had danced with her 5 times that night. "Dancing wouldn't do it," Mark said, and went on to explain the basics of leaving a DNA trail. Blood, saliva, hair, sweat, semen. "They have DNA from the semen," Mark said. Gore's expression changed dramatically, and he was obviously bothered by this information. He called time and left to go find his legal advisor. He returned with Reuben, a jailhouse lawyer. While he was away, Sarah Bonnell asked a guard for a Q-tip. "Glenn, would you give a saliva sample?" Sarah asked, holding the Q-tip. Gore grabbed the Q-tip, snapped it in two, cleaned both ears, then dropped the 2 halves into his shirt pocket. "Did you have sex with her?" Mark asked. Gore wouldn't respond. "Are you saying you never had sex with her?" Mark asked again. "I'm not saying that." "If you did, that semen is going to match up to your DNA." "I didn't do it," Gore said. "I can't help you." He and Reuben stood, and the interview was over. As they were leaving, Mark Barrett asked Gore if they could meet again. "Sure," said Gore, "but it might be better if they met at his job site." Job site? Mark thought he was serving a 40-year prison sentence. Gore explained that during the day he worked in Purcell, Sarah Bonnell's hometown, in the Public Works Department. "Catch him over there, and they could have a longer talk." Mark and Sarah agreed, though both were taken aback by Gore's outside employment. That afternoon, Mark called Mary Long, who was then in charge of the DNA testing section of the OSBI, and suggested that they find Gore's DNA in the prison data bank and compare it with the semen samples from the crime scene. She agreed to do so. Dennis Fritz was locked in his cell for the 4:15 p.m. count. He heard the familiar voice of a prisoner counselor in the hall, beyond his metal door. The voice yelled, "Hey, Fritz! You're a free man!" Then something about DNA! Dennis couldn't get out of his cell, and the counselor disappeared. His cellmate heard it too, and they spent the rest of the night talking about what it meant. It was too late to call New York. Dennis suffered through the night, slept little, and tried unsuccessfully to throttle his excitement. When he reached the Innocence Project early the next morning, the news was confirmed. DNA testing had excluded Dennis and Ron from the semen found at the crime scene. Dennis was euphoric. Almost 12 years after he was arrested, the truth was finally known. The proof was ironclad and irrefutable. He would be vindicated and exonerated and set free. He called his mother, and she was overcome with emotion. He called his daughter, Elizabeth, now 25 years old, and they celebrated. They had not seen each other in 12 years, and they talked about how sweet the reunion would be. To safeguard the crime scene hair and also the samples given by Fritz and Williamson, Mark Barrett arranged for an expert to examine the hair and to microscopically photograph it with an infrared camera. Less than 3 weeks after the hearing on the motion to dismiss, LabCorp completed the first stage testing and sent back an inconclusive report. Mark Barrett and Sarah Bunnell drove to Ada for a meeting in the chambers of the judge. Tom Landreth was anxious to get the answers that only DNA could provide. Because of the complexities of DNA testing, various labs were being used to test different hairs, and because of the distrust between the prosecution and the defense, different labs were necessary. A total of 5 labs were eventually involved in the case. The lawyers discussed this with Judge Landreth, and again he pressed them to do it as fast as possible. After the hearing, Mark and Sarah walked downstairs in the courthouse to Bill Peterson's office. In correspondence and in hearings, he was growing increasingly hostile. Perhaps they could thaw things a bit with a friendly visit. Instead, they heard a tirade. Peterson was still convinced Ron Williamson had raped and murdered Debbie Carter, and his evidence had not changed. Forget the DNA. Forget the experts from the OSBI. Williamson was a bad guy who'd raped women in Tulsa and hung out in bars and roamed the streets with his guitar and lived close to Debbie Carter. Peterson vehemently believed that Gary Allen, Fritz's neighbor, had actually seen Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz in the yard the night of the murder washing off blood with a water hose while laughing and cursing. They had to be guilty. Peterson ranted on and on, working harder to reassure himself than to convince Mark and Sarah. They were dumbfounded. The man was thoroughly incapable of admitting a mistake or grasping the reality of the situation. The month of March seemed like a year for Dennis Fritz. The euphoria vanished, and he struggled to get through each day. He was obsessed with the possibility of hair samples being switched by Peterson or someone at the OSBI. With the semen issue put to rest, the state would be desperate to salvage its case with the only evidence it had left. If he and Ron were cleared by DNA testing of the hair, then they would walk and the bogus prosecution would be exposed. Reputations were on the line. Everything was out of his control, and Dennis was overcome with stress. He feared a heart attack and visited the prison clinic, complaining of heart palpitations. The pills they gave him did little to help. The days dragged on. Then April arrived. The excitement faded for Ron, too. The extreme euphoria crashed into another round of severe depression and anxiety, and he became suicidal. He called Mark Barrett often, and his lawyer kept reassuring him. Mark accepted every call, and when he wasn't in the office, he made sure someone there talked to the client. Ron, like Dennis, was terrified of the authorities cooking the test results. Both were in prison because of the state's experts, people who still had access to the evidence. It wasn't difficult to imagine a scenario in which the hair could be compromised in an effort to protect people and cover up an injustice. Ron had made no secret of his desire to sue everybody in sight once he was set free. People in higher places had to be nervous. Ron called as often as he was permitted, usually once a day. He was paranoid and offered all sorts of nightmarish plots. At one point, Mark Barrett did something he had never done before and would probably never do again. He guaranteed Ron that he would get him out of prison. If the DNA fell through, then they would go to trial and Mark guaranteed an acquittal. Comforting words from an experienced lawyer, and Ron was calm for a few days. Hair samples don't match was the headline of the Sunday edition of the Ada paper on April 11th. Ann Kelly reported that LabCorp had tested 14 of 17 hairs taken from the crime scene, and they were in no way consistent with Fritz or Williamson's DNA makeup. Bill Peterson said, "At this point, we don't know who the hairs belong to. We haven't tested them against anybody but Fritz and Williamson. There was no question in my mind when we started the whole DNA process that these two men were guilty. I wanted it, physical evidence, sent off for the purpose of getting these two guys. When we got the results on the semen samples, I was so surprised, my jaw dropped to the floor." The final report was due from the lab the following Wednesday, April 14th. Judge Landreth scheduled a hearing for April 15th, and there was speculation that the two men might be set free. Fritz and Williamson would both be in court on the 15th. And Barry Scheck was coming to town. Scheck's fame was growing enormously as the Innocence Project pulled off one DNA exoneration after another. And when word circulated that he would be in Ada for yet another one, the media circus began. State and national news companies called Mark Barrett, Judge Landreth, Bill Peterson, the Innocence Project, the Carter family, all the major players. Excitement built quickly. Would Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz really walk free on Thursday? Dennis Fritz had not heard the results of the hair tests. On Tuesday, April 13th, he was in his cell when a guard appeared from nowhere and barked, "Pack your shit, you're leaving." Dennis knew he was going back to Ada, hopefully for his release. He packed quickly, said goodbye to a couple of friends, and hurried away. There to drive him back to Ada was none other than John Christian, a familiar face from the Pontotoc County Jail. 12 years in jail and prison had taught Dennis to treasure his privacy and his freedom, and to appreciate the little things, like open spaces and forests and flowers. Spring was everywhere, and as he headed back to Ada, he smiled through the window at the farms and rolling hills and countryside. His thoughts were random. He did not know of the latest test results, nor was he certain why he was headed back to Ada. There was a chance he would be released, and there was also the chance that a last-minute hitch would derail things. 12 years earlier, he'd almost been released during his preliminary hearing when Judge Miller realized the state had so little proof. Then the cops and Peterson produced James Harjo, and Dennis went to trial, then to prison. He thought of Elizabeth and how wonderful it would be to see and hold her. He couldn't wait to get out of Oklahoma. Then he was scared again. He was so close to freedom, yet he was still wearing handcuffs and headed for a jail. Ann Kelly and a photographer were waiting for him. He smiled as he entered the jail and was eager to talk to the reporter. "This case should never have been prosecuted," he said for the newspaper. "The evidence they had against me was insufficient, and if the police had done an adequate investigation of all the suspects, this may never have happened." He explained the problems with the indigent defense system. "When you don't have any money to defend yourself, you're at the mercy of the judicial system. Once in the system, it's almost impossible to get out, even if you are innocent." He spent a quiet night in his old haunt, dreaming of freedom. The quietness of the jail was disrupted the next day, April 14th, when Ron Williamson arrived from Vinita, wearing prison stripes and grinning at the cameras. The word was out that they would be released the following day, and the story had caught the attention of the national press. Ron and Dennis had not seen each other in 11 years. Each had written to the other only once, but when they were reunited, they hugged and laughed and tried to grasp the reality of where they were and what was happening. The lawyers arrived, and they talked to them for an hour. NBC's Dateline was there with a camera recording everything. Jim Dwyer with the New York Daily News had arrived with Barry Scheck. They were packed in the small interview room on the east side of the jail, facing the courthouse. At one point, Ron stretched out on the floor, looked through the glass door, and rested his head in his hand. Finally, someone asked, "Hey, Ron, what are you doing?"
"Waiting on Peterson," he said.
The courthouse lawn was crawling with reporters and cameras. One happened to catch Bill Peterson, who agreed to an interview. When Ron saw the prosecutor in front of the courthouse, he yelled at the door,
"You fat rascal! We beat you, Peterson!"
Dennis's mother and daughter surprised him at the jail. Though he and Elizabeth had maintained an active correspondence, and she had sent him many photos, he was unprepared for what he saw. She was a beautiful, elegant, very mature young lady of 25, and he wept uncontrollably as he hugged her. There were many tears at the jail that afternoon. Ron and Dennis were placed in separate cells, lest they start killing again. Sheriff Glaze explained,
"I'm going to keep them apart. I just don't feel right putting two convicted murderers in the same cell together. And until the judge says so, that's what they are."
Their cells were side by side, and so they talked. Dennis's cellmate had a small television, and from news reports he heard firsthand that they would be released the following day. Dennis relayed all this to Ron. To no one's surprise, Terry Holland was back in jail, another layover in her astonishing career as a petty criminal. She and Ron exchanged words, but nothing particularly unpleasant. As the night wore on, Ron lapsed into his old habits. He began yelling about his freedom and injustices, shouting obscenities at the female inmates, and talking loudly to God. Chapter 15. The exonerations of Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz brought national attention to Ada. By daybreak on April 15th, the courthouse was surrounded by news vans, satellite trucks, photographers, cameramen, and reporters. The townsfolk drifted over, curious at the commotion and anxious to see more. So much jockeying had gone on for seats in the courtroom that Judge Landreth was forced to improvise a lottery system for the reporters and a one-line live feed out of his office window for the news trucks. A collection of cameras was waiting outside the jail, and when the two defendants emerged, they were surrounded. Ron was wearing a coat and tie, dress shirt, and slacks that Annette had hurriedly bought for him, and he had new shoes that were too small and killing his feet. Dennis's mother had brought him a suit, but he preferred the street clothes he'd been allowed to wear during his last years in prison. They quickly made their final walk in handcuffs, smiling and bantering with the reporters. Annette and Renee arrived early and took their usual seats, front row behind the defense table. They held hands and prayed, cried, and managed a laugh or two. It was too early to celebrate. They were joined by their children, other relatives, and some friends. Wanda and Elizabeth Fritz sat nearby, also holding hands and whispering excitedly. The courtroom filled up. The Carter family sat across the aisle, once more dragged into court to suffer through another hearing as the state floundered in its efforts to solve their crime and find justice. 17 years after Debbie's murder, and her first two accused and convicted killers were about to walk. The seats were soon filled, and the crowd began stacking up along the walls. Judge Landreth had agreed to allow cameras, and he herded the photographers and reporters into the jury box, where folding chairs were brought in and wedged against each other. Cops and deputies were everywhere. Security was tight. There had been anonymous phone calls and threats against Ron and Dennis. The courtroom was packed and tension was high. Lots of cops were present, though Dennis Smith and Gary Rogers were somewhere else. The lawyers arrived, Mark, Sarah, and Barry Scheck for the defendants, Bill Peterson, Nancy Hsu, and Chris Ross for the state. There were smiles and handshakes. The state was joining in the motion to dismiss, to set the boys free. This was a joint effort to right a wrong, a rare example of the community coming together at a crucial hour to properly address an injustice. One big happy family. Everyone should be congratulated and take pride in the system that was working so beautifully. Ron and Dennis were brought in, and their handcuffs were removed for the last time. They sat behind their lawyers, a few feet away from their families. Ron stared straight ahead and saw little. Dennis, though, looked at the crowd and saw glum, hard faces. Most of those present did not seem too happy with the prospect of their release. Judge Landreth assumed the bench, welcomed everyone, and quickly got down to business. He asked Peterson to call his first witness. Mary Long, now the head of the DNA unit at the OSBI, took the stand and began with an overview of the testing process. She talked about the different labs that had been used to analyze the hair and semen from the crime scene and the samples from the suspects. Ron and Dennis began to sweat. They had thought the hearing would take only a few minutes, time enough for Judge Landreth to dismiss the charges and send them home. As the minutes crept by, they began to worry. Ron began to fidget and grumble, "What's going on?" Sarah Bunnell scribbled notes to assure him things were fine. Dennis was a nervous wreck. Where was the testimony leading? Could there be another surprise? Every trip to that courtroom had been a nightmare. Sitting in it now evoked harrowing memories of lying witnesses and stone-faced jurors and Peterson demanding the death penalty. Dennis made the mistake of again glancing around the courtroom, and again did not see many supporters. Mary Long turned to the important material. 17 hairs taken from the crime scene were tested, 13 pubic, 4 scalp. 10 of the hairs were found on the bed or in the bedding. 2 came from the torn panties, 3 from the washcloth in the victim's mouth, and 2 from under her body. Only 4 of the 17 could be matched with a DNA profile. 2 belonged to Debbie, and none came from Ron or Dennis. 0. Long then testified that the semen samples taken from the bedding, the torn panties, and the victim had been tested earlier, and of course, Ron and Dennis had been excluded. She was then excused from the witness stand. In 1988, Melvin Hett testified that of the 17 hairs, 13 were microscopically consistent with the hair of Dennis, and 4 with Ron's samples. There was even a match. Also, in his third and final report, filed after Dennis's trial had started, Hett excluded Glenn Gore from any of the hair. His expert testimony was the only direct, credible proof the state offered against both Ron and Dennis, and had much to do with their convictions. DNA testing revealed that one scalp hair found under the body and one pubic hair found in the bedding had been left behind by Glenn Gore. Also, the semen recovered by a vaginal swab during the autopsy was tested. Its source was Glenn Gore. Judge Landreth knew this but had kept it confidential until the hearing. With his approval, Bill Peterson announced the Gore findings to a shocked courtroom. Peterson said, "Your Honor, this is a very trying time for the criminal justice system. This murder happened in 1982. It was tried in 1988. At that particular time, we had evidence that was presented to a jury that convicted Dennis Fritz and Ron Williamson by evidence that was, in my opinion, at that particular time, overwhelming." Without refreshing memories as to what exactly the overwhelming proof had been 11 years earlier, he rambled on about how DNA now contradicted much of what he had once believed. Based on the evidence he had left, he could not prosecute the two defendants. He asked that the motion to dismiss be granted, then sat down. At no time did Peterson offer any conciliatory comments or words of regret or admissions of errors made, or even an apology. At the least, Ron and Dennis were expecting an apology. 12 years of their lives had been stolen by malfeasance, human error, and arrogance. The injustice they had endured could easily have been avoided, and the state owed them something as simple as an apology. It would never happen, and it became an open sore that never healed. Judge Landreth made a few comments about the injustice of it all, then asked Ron and Dennis to stand. He announced that all charges were thereby dismissed. They were free men, free to go. There was applause and cheering from a few of the spectators. Most, though, were not in the mood to celebrate. Annette and Renee hugged their children and relatives and had another good cry. Ron bolted from the defense table, past the jury box, out a side door, down the stairs to the front steps of the courthouse, where he paused and filled his lungs with cool air. Then he lit a cigarette, the first of a million in the free world, and waved it jubilantly at a camera. The photo was printed in dozens of newspapers. A few minutes later, he was back. He and Dennis, their families and lawyers, huddled in the courtroom and posed for photos and answered questions from a horde of reporters. Mark Barrett had called Greg Wilhoit and asked him to fly back to Oklahoma for the big day. When Ron saw Greg, they embraced like the brothers they were. "How do you feel, Mr. Williamson?" a reporter asked.
"About what?" Ron shot back, then said, "I feel like my feet are killing me. These shoes are too small."
The questions went on for an hour, even though a press conference was planned for later. Peggy Stillwell was helped from the courtroom by her daughters and sisters. She was overwhelmed and in shock. The family had not been warned of the news of Glenn Gore. They were back at the murder scene now, waiting for another trial, no closer to justice. And they were confused. Most of the family still believed Fritz and Williamson were guilty, but how did Gore figure in? Ron and Dennis finally began their exit, every step of it duly preserved and recorded. The mob crept down the stairs and out the front door. They paused for a second, free men now, and soaked in the sun and chilly air. They were liberated, free, exonerated, yet no one had offered an apology, an explanation, or even a dime in compensation, not a shred of aid of any type. It was time for lunch. Ron's favorite place was Bob's Barbecue, north of town. Annette called ahead and reserved several tables. Several would be needed because the entourage was growing by the minute. Though he had only a few teeth left, and though it would otherwise have been difficult to eat with so many cameras in his face, Ron devoured a plateful of pork ribs and wanted more. Never one to savor his food, he did manage to savor the moment. He was polite to everyone, thanked all the strangers who stopped by to encourage him, hugged those who wanted a hug, chatted with every reporter who wanted a story. He and Dennis couldn't stop smiling, even with mouths full of barbecue. The day before, Jim Dwyer, a reporter for the New York Daily News, and Alexandra Pelosi of NBC's Dateline, drove to Purcell to find Glenn Gore and ask him some questions. Gore knew things were heating up over in Ada and that he was rapidly becoming the prime suspect, but remarkably, the prison staff did not. Gore heard that some out-of-towners were looking for him and assumed they were lawyers or law enforcement types, people he'd rather avoid. Around noon, he walked away from his job cleaning ditches in Purcell and escaped. He found some woods and walked several miles, then stumbled upon a highway and hitchhiked in the general direction of Ada. When Ron and Dennis heard of Gore's escape, they howled with laughter. He must be guilty. After a long lunch, the Fritz Williamson group drove to the lodge in Wintersmith Park in Ada for a press conference. Joined by their lawyers, Ron and Dennis sat behind a long table and faced the cameras. Scheck talked about the Innocence Project and its work to free those wrongly convicted. Mark Barrett was asked how the injustice occurred in the first place, and he gave a long history of the misguided prosecution, the 5-year delay, the lazy and suspicious police work, the snitches, the junk science. Most of the questions were directed at the two brand new exonerees. Dennis said he planned to leave Oklahoma, go back to Kansas City, and spend as much time as possible with Elizabeth. And in due course, he would figure out the rest of his life. Ron had no immediate plans, except to get out of Ada. Their panel was joined by Greg Wilhoit and Tim Durham, another Oklahoma exoneree from Tulsa. Tim spent 4 years in prison for a rape he did not commit before the Innocence Project secured his release with DNA testing. At the federal courthouse in Muskogee, Jim Payne, Vicki Hildebrand, and Gail Seward quietly suppressed their deep satisfaction. There was no celebration. Their work on the Williamson matter was now 4 years removed, and they were knee-deep in other cases, but they nonetheless paused to savor the moment. Long before DNA erased the mysteries, they had found the truth the old way, with brains and sweat, and in doing so, had saved the life of an innocent man. Judge C. wasn't smug, either. The vindication was sweet, but he was much too busy with other matters. He had simply done his job, that was all. Though every other judge along the way had failed Ron Williamson, Frank C. understood the system and knew its flaws. The truth was often hard to find, but he was willing to search for it, and he knew where to look. Mark Barrett had asked Annette to find a place for the press conference and perhaps a little reception, something nice in the way of a homecoming for Ron and Dennis. She knew just the place, the fellowship hall of her church, the same church in which Ronnie grew up, the same church where she had played both the piano and the organ for the past 40 years. The day before, she had called her pastor to ask permission and arrange the details. He hesitated, stuttered a bit, then finally said he needed to poll the elders. Annette smelled trouble and headed for the church. When she arrived, the pastor said that he had called the elders, and it was their opinion, and his as well, that the church should be off-limits for such an event. Annette was stunned and asked why. "There could be violence," he explained. There were already reports of threats against Ron and Dennis, and things might get out of control. The town was buzzing about the release, with most folks unhappy with it. There were some tough guys on the Carter side, and, well, it just wouldn't work. "But this church has been praying for Ronnie for 12 years, she reminded him. "Yes, indeed, and we will continue to do so," he said. "But there are a lot of people who still think he's guilty. It's too controversial. The church could be tainted. The answer is no." Annette became emotional and ran from his office. He tried to console her, but she would have none of it. She left and called Renee. Within minutes, Gary Simmons was driving to Ada, some 3 hours from their home near Dallas. Gary drove straight to the church and confronted the pastor, who held his ground. They argued for a long time, but resolved nothing. The church was standing firm. It was simply too risky. "Ron will be here Sunday morning," Gary said. "Will you recognize him?" "No," the pastor said. The celebration resumed at Annette's house, where dinner was served and friends filtered in and out. After the dishes were done, everyone gathered in the sunroom, where an old-fashioned gospel sing-along erupted. Barry Shack, a Jewish guy from New York, heard music he'd never heard before, and gamely tried to sing along. Mark Barrett was there. It was a proud and remarkable moment for him, and he didn't want to leave. Sarah Bonnell, Janet Chesley, and Kim Marks all sang along. Greg Wilhoit and his sister Nancy were there. The Fritz family, Dennis, Elizabeth, and Wanda, sat close together and joined in the fun. "That night, everyone stayed around for the celebration party at Annette's house," Renee said. "There was lots of food, singing, laughter. Annette was playing the piano, Ronnie playing the guitar, and the rest of us joining and singing a variety of songs. Everyone was singing, clapping, having such a good time." Then, at 10 o'clock, there was silence as the news came on the television. We were all sitting in the sunroom, wall-to-wall people, waiting to hear the news we had longed to hear for so many years, announcing to the town that my little brother, Ronald Keith Williamson, was not only free, but innocent.